Well, good afternoon, and thank you again for tuning into our podcast, Hot Topics for Retirement Plan Sponsors. Our topic for today is cybersecurity and ERISA plans. You know, it's certainly a topic that's front and center for many of us, but today we're going to look specifically at the impact on ERISA plans. And I'll be speaking with Marina Edwards. Marina joined Invesco in January of 2020 as a senior DC strategist. She's had a 30-year career focused on ERISA compliance and fiduciary risk management. Her areas of specialization include plan governance, compliance, fiduciary training, vendor search, and plan benchmarking. And my name is Bruce Lanzer. I'm a senior retirement plan consultant with UBS, and I have nearly 40 years' experience working with retirement plan fiduciaries to maximize their fiduciary protection and help their employees achieve their financial goals and their employees prepare for retirement. So with that, let me introduce Marina, who will share her insights into cybersecurity.
Yes, hi, and thank you for having me on your podcast today. Happy to be here. So one of the things that we are beginning to see as an evolving trend in the 401k space is, unfortunately, it's fraud and it's cyber hacks that are happening inside the 401k plan where employee money goes missing out of the account. And so maybe before we get into how this is happening, I'd like to pause and ask your audience a couple questions as they begin to tee up this topic and what it could mean to themselves and to the clients that your clients serve and the participants. So the question is, if you had, say, $2,000 or $3,000 that went missing out of your 401k plan, would you know that that would have been gone based on fraud? Or would you think it was maybe market value fluctuation? Most of us have done a pretty good job of beginning to accumulate a 401k account balance, and the industry has done a really great job of using this set it and forget it kind of mentality so that we don't panic as 401k investors when the market is, you know, very volatile with high highs and low lows. So the set it and forget it, we're not paying attention to our 401k account balance. We know we're doing a good job contributing and saving and getting the match, and we'll address the account balance later on in our careers when it gets closer to retirement. The problem with this, Bruce, that we're seeing is the hackers have now found ways to get into the 401k plans the same way or in similar ways that they're finding their way into our checking and savings accounts and into our credit card accounts and our email accounts. So one of the most common ways that we're beginning to address this is building awareness around it. So it begins with podcasts like this, Bruce, where we can educate folks that, yes, this is beginning to happen. And what do employers need to be thinking about it as they sponsor these 401k plans? And what do us as individuals who have our 401k account balances, what should we be doing as well? So it's kind of this two-faceted conversation that I'd like to have with our audience today. Maybe we'll start by just giving you one or two key statistics that the FBI has released in its internet crime report dated 2020. In this report, they stated that there are over 2,000 complaints received per day on average for fraud and internet crime. And the losses that us as individuals have incurred with internet crime in the year of 2020, it's $4.2 billion. So when we are thinking about fraud and cyber attacks, we might not understand how they're happening because we might not be cyber experts, but we definitely know the value of our 401k account. And we know that we need to be protecting it and thinking about it and monitoring it the same way that we do our checking and savings accounts. So I want to, like I said, take a little bit of time and just walk through how do we do that. So we thought it might be helpful to just commonly explain how some of these hacks are happening. And while there are some that are, you know, breaking code and rewriting code to penetrate into a record keeping system and to take over an account, believe it or not, one of the more obvious and easy to understand ways that hackers are getting in is they simply are using data, your own personal data from the dark web, and they're calling in to the 401k record keeping call center and impersonating you as an individual. So for many people, we will list who our employer is, whether it's on LinkedIn or Facebook. And so hackers can target, and they might know that you work for, I'll just use me. They might know that you work for Invesco. And you can go look at 5,500 information, and you can look up Invesco's 401k plan, and you can see that our record keeper is Schwab. So the hacker that might be trying to get into an Invesco employee's account would call Schwab and, you know, come up with this sob story, as the hacker might do, saying, you know, I'm under financial duress and I need to take a withdrawal out of my 401k account, but I've lost my passwords to do this online. So they're speaking with a live representative. And the call center rep says, sure, let me see if I can help you with that. And most of us have all had these questions asked through a call center. Can you give me some information? I just need to ask you a couple more questions to help validate that you are who you say you are. So can you give me the last four digits of your social security number? The hacker, yes, delivers that because they have it from the dark web. Can you give me your full complete mailing address? Yes, they have that information. Can you validate your date of birth? Yes. And again, the hackers have this information. So at that point, the call center representative says, thank you. We've got yourself authenticated. Now let's look at your plan rules and what balances you have in your different buckets of money. And let's see what might be available for a withdrawal. So they go through the options. The hacker then says, great, I'd like these dollars taken from my account. Can you help me set up my bank information? And can we wire those dollars over to my bank account tomorrow morning? So the customer service representative on the phone says, yes, you know, give me your routing number and your checking account number. We'll enter that in here. You might have to pay a $25 overnight ACH fee in order for the wire to go tonight. Sure, just take it out of my account proceeds. Mm-hmm. And the wire is sent over to the hacker's checking account. By the time then that the mailing confirmation gets back to the participant or the employee, the hacker's checking account has been closed and the money's been withdrawn and it's gone. And at that point, for most cases, it's irretrievable. So we then have this issue of who makes the participant's account whole. There's trust law that says that dollars inside of a 401k have to be used for the exclusive benefit of the participant or their beneficiaries. So this is money that went missing from the trust, and it's not being used for the exclusive benefit of the participants. So the account needs to be made whole. So and then you get into an exercise of finger pointing. The participant says, I didn't take it. The employer says, I didn't take it, and we didn't do anything wrong. And the record keeper says, well, we followed our processes, so we didn't do anything wrong. So there's this finger pointing. And then the participant, in many cases, will begin to bring a lawsuit to say, somebody needs to make my account whole. So these are the unfortunate happenings that are beginning to become more prevalent. And we're also starting to see these cases show up in litigation against the plan sponsor.
Marina, what are some things that, you know, participant can do, you know, before they've been hacked and after they've been hacked?
Sure. So think about each of us. And I really encourage the listeners to think about your own 401k account. I mean, many of us are, you know, retirement professionals and financial professionals where we're providing this advice to our employers and plan sponsor clients and their employees. But this actually applies to each of us as individuals. So the first one that I think about is each of us really need to be monitoring our own 401k account balances at least on an annual basis. So I'm trying to encourage plan sponsors to make this a checklist step for open enrollment. What if we could get each employee each October or November when open enrollment happens, where we're going to go into our record keeper account, our 401k account balance, and we're going to run a report to see out of, you know, my own account, have there been any withdrawals or distributions this last year that I'm not aware of? And what a great, easy extra step for us. But again, we've been on this set it and forget it. So many of us aren't looking at our quarterly statements or even our account balance on an annual basis. And when we really need to start doing that, think about how we check our checking account. and we check our credit card statements, but our 401k account balance is our largest asset for many of us. And we aren't using the same, what I'm going to call financial hygiene. We're not using that on one of our biggest assets. The second thing is making sure that you get into your account and set up entering in your cell phone number to do two-factor authentication, where they can send you a text of a number to enter into the online web account. So that two-factor authentication is very, very effective. When we're auto-enrolling new folks, new employees into the plan, many times these new employees, because they've been auto-enrolled and auto-escalated, auto-invested, they're not going in and paying attention to their 401k account. They're not setting it up. And these unclaimed or unauthenticated accounts can be prime targets for the hackers to get into, where the hacker can get into the account and then set up those participant communication vehicles like quarterly statements, and they can set up their own passwords, and they can set up their own special questions to be asking, their own banking information, and it's all the hacker's information, not the employee's. So those are two common ones.
That's a good point with, you know, the unclaimed accounts, because when I talk to participants, many times they've never gone online, never set up, you know, online access to their account, and they think they're more secure that way if they never go online. But as you pointed out, Marina, if there's these kind of unclaimed accounts, if you will, the hacker will set it up.
That's right. I mean, and I think as advisors and plan sponsors, we can ask our record keepers to give us a report, at least on a, you know, semi-annual basis, who has been enrolled, who has not gone in and claimed their accounts. And maybe those are great outreaches to those participants. Make a quick phone call to them saying how important it is and the reasons why. This is an issue that is not going to go away. The hackers have found their way in, and it kind of like the assets are ripe for picking for these hackers. So we need to be smarter and using some of this, what I would call common sense, to help protect our accounts. You know, the other thing that we're seeing that participants are able to do is when you begin to look at your account and you do have it all set up for self-authentication and so forth with your own data, ask the record keeper to please lock down your account, where there is no distributions that are allowed unless you have like a 4-digit passcode for them, like a PIN on your own 401k account. So there are some record keepers that are beginning to expand their capabilities to allow these lockdowns of the accounts as another layer of defense against the hackers.
I did go and set up my account to kind of freeze it, if you will, to prevent any distributions. And it was a very simple process. As you mentioned, there's a extra layer, an extra code that I have to give them if I ever wanted to remove the freeze. But it's an extra step beyond just, you know, Social Security number, date of birth, and the basic information that is often used to authenticate.
I have that with my cell phone carrier. And if the cell phone carriers are putting that kind of two-factor authentication and the special account digits in place, and that doesn't even house, you know, large assets that belong to us.
Right.
You know, it's just and I would say just our cell phones, because our cell phones do contain a lot of data. But boy, our 401k accounts are really, really valuable, and we need that same level of care and attention to those as well.
Exactly.
So if we shift gears maybe a little bit to talk about what can the employers do, what should we be thinking about as employers to help, you know, strengthen their fiduciary process around this? The Department of Labor saw this as a new issue that was creeping up. And this last fall, they came forward with three documents. So there's three PDF documents that the DOL put out that provide guidance on things that plan sponsors should do and check to ensure that their cyber and fraud policies and procedures for the 401k plan are being attended to. So the first PDF covers what are 12 best practices for ERISA-covered plans. So the prescription is to identify which of the service providers to the 401k plan are using personal identifiable information, or PII. So clearly the record keeper has the PII. If you have managed accounts, usually that managed accounts provider will get a file from the record keeper that's got PII. So we're going to need to check the cyber protocol for the record keeper, the cyber protocol that's in place for the managed account provider, whether there's a separate self-directed provider. Clearly, they will be getting personal identifiable information. So I want our listeners to think more broadly about where that PII is being distributed to in order to operate the 401k plan. As fiduciaries, we need to be issuing requests for information on this topic of cyber to each of those different service providers and understanding what their procedures are. Have they had gaps? Have there been penetration by the hackers? What is the development that they have for new technology coming up in the next 12 months? Right. So there's just good due diligence that we should be asking about how the data and the assets are being protected. The second PDF is to review the service provider contract. So the DOL provides this checklist for plan sponsors to use that will help identify and defining the security obligations, indemnifications that the record keepers and service providers might have. They'll inquire about the reporting back to clients, monitoring responsibilities on those service providers. So that's the second piece. And then the third piece that the DOL blessed us with was a sample participant communication or an account tip sheet for participants. And the intent of this is to educate the participants on protecting their assets. If you do find that money has gone missing out of your account, what do you do? Who do you contact? And, you know, they'll begin to work through then what that process looks like to get your account restored. It's interesting, Bruce, that many people don't think that if money went missing out of my 401k, that first call to response is usually the FBI. Hmm. You might think it would be your local police. It's actually usually FBI because if the wire is moving from your record keeper to the hacker's account and they happen to be in different states or even different countries, obviously different states falls into FBI jurisdiction. So getting to know your local FBI office and agent for large plan sponsors is actually a recommended best step.
Interesting. We never would have thought of that.
Yeah. And I actually heard that tip from an FBI gentleman that was presenting on cyber and fraud. And he welcomed plan sponsors to get to know the local FBI offices and some of those people so that when a claim does come into the FBI, that relationship between the FBI and the employer has already been established. So that was from the words of an FBI agent himself. So kind of neat.
Right. You know, it's been fairly recent that the DOL provided their list of 12 best practices. Would you say that constitutes a safe harbor of sorts for the plan sponsor?
That's a great question. I would not see it as a safe harbor. We know with fiduciary lawsuits, so much of where plan sponsors get pinched is they have got a process in place that they're not following, or there's simply no process in place and they're not following. Mm-hmm. So when I like to think about the word safe harbor and what can I do, what practices can I do to get safe harbor like status, it's having a written process and then making sure as a committee that we're following that process. And I think if you've got the written process that we will review cyber and fraud at the fiduciary committee meeting minutes, at least on an annual basis, and then making sure that you're documenting it, that you've reviewed it, you've done the RFIs out to your service providers, you've reviewed the service contracts, you've communicated to your plan participants, and you're documenting each one of these steps, that is solid fiduciary guidance. And I would say is as close as you can get to that quote safe harbor, if you will.
Okay.
One of the other areas that a lot of plan sponsors are asking about is insurance coverage. So if we had money that went missing from some of our participant accounts in our 401k plan, and we need to make that participant whole, who pays for that? And I'll share that most record keepers do have a make whole policy. So it's good. That's a great question to be asking in your RFI. Do you have a make whole policy? And what are the requirements that the plan sponsor needs to do in order to effectuate that make whole policy? And what things do participants need to do? So usually they'll be asking participants to, you know, make sure they have two-factor authentication on, that they're changing their password every 90 days, so forth. But one of the other areas is understanding the insurance coverages for cyber and where does the 401k plan fit within that. So let me explain that a little bit deeper. When we think about insurance at a corporation level, there's usually your professional liability, whether it's E&O, D&O, or however way that they want to structure that. There's professional liability. There's usually a policy for fiduciary liability. There's usually a separate policy for fidelity insurance. And then sometimes there's an actual separate policy for cyber and network security. The question is, where does the 401k plan coverage, where is it across these policies? Beware that there are some of these policies that can have carve-outs for their 401k plans. So do you know, does the employer know, where is their 401k plan covered across these different policies? And some cases, there might be gaps. So it's a healthy exercise for plan sponsors to be reviewing their corporate insurance coverage with a specific focus on where is our 401k plan covered if we had a loss that, you know, our record keeper said that they weren't going to cover, so that the employer is going to have to cover it. And is there proper coverage for that? And I, in my experience, Bruce, this is an area where many plan sponsors will look at you like deer in the headlights. We don't know. So this is an excellent exercise that we're encouraging plan sponsors to review their insurance policy coverages. And again, where does that 401k plan reside within those policy coverages?
Right, good advice.
The other thing that's starting to crop up with respect to insurance is the underwriting. Because we're seeing lawsuits with missing money out of 401k accounts, the insurance underwriters want to know how well the plan is being administered and whether or not there's been an eye or a review on the cyber and the fraud policies. So they're beginning to ask detailed questions to the plan sponsors of these 401k plans. And they're wanting to know about whether the committees are going through these DOL, you know, prescriptions of reviewing their policies and reviewing this, their service contracts and communicating with participants. And they're, you know, asking a whole host of detailed underwriting questions. We've seen and heard from the underwriters that the questions that are being asked and how they're answered is dictating what the premiums are being offered. So if you haven't done some of these best practices on cyber and fraud, expect your insurance underwriting costs and the insurance premium costs to go up. So there's a kind of a dotted line connection that's happening there.
What are some of the questions that they're asking now that they maybe weren't in prior years?
First of all, the questions, I mean, the obvious ones are, has your plan had a breach? Have you had any participants that have lost money? So have you been engaged with your record keeper on any of these questions? They're also wanting to know whether or not the committees have good fiduciary processes in place as a general, like general governance. So they're asking about, do you RFP your plan and how frequently? Are you paying your record keepers on a flat per head basis, or are you using revenue sharing? These are some questions that are also triggering lawsuits that are different from cyber and fraud, but the policy is still being applied to the 401k plan, so that the insurance underwriters are very interested in this. The other service provider to the plan that's interested in these types of questions are the plan auditors. So auditors are keying in on these kind of fiduciary best practices, like, are you benchmarking the plan fees? Are you taking the plan out to bid every 5 to 6 years, whether you need it or not? How are you communicating your fund investment options and the expenses to the plan? How are you communicating that to your plan participants? Right. So there's this whole list of, you know, common questions that both audit firms and insurance underwriters are beginning to delve into. One thing to be cautious about when answering these questions is, if you communicate your answers to these questions back to your insurance underwriter or to the audit plan auditor, you could be sending a potential smoking gun and a paper trail to your insurance underwriter or to your plan's audit firm. So, for example, if the plan hasn't been out to bid for 15 years, and the general rule of thumb is you do that every 5 to 6 years, whether you need it or not, and you answer the question truthfully, which is, you know, the last time we took it out to bid was 15 years ago, that can be a potential fiduciary breach. And the underwriters might say, we're nervous about that. So we know that there's a greater degree that if you got sued on that, that it would be hard to defend. So we're going to increase your premiums because, you know, as an insurance provider, we're nervous about that. So that's just one example of depending on how you answer some of these questions, it could drive higher insurance costs. What I think is happening, though, is with the audits focused on these issues, the insurance companies are focused on these issues. Plan sponsors and participants, we're aware of cyber and fraud and the litigation issues. And I'm hoping that over time that we're all going to be sharpening our pencils and our procedures with this so that some of these more egregious fiduciary claims are going to be less prevalent. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I think is interesting, Bruce, is that if the DOL is going to give us these three PDFs of guidance, you can bet that they're going to come back and do some audits.
Right.
And that's exactly what we've started to see. So right on the heels of the DOL issuing their guidance for cyber and fraud for ERISA plans, they began random audits. Well, let's just go into company ABC, send them an audit letter, ask for a whole bunch of good due diligence documents that we would hope that they would have in their fiduciary file, and see how we do. So the questions that are showing up on these DOL cyber audits is quite interesting. And in my experience, an area where most plan sponsors right now are just starting to get involved. So for example, could you answer the question, what are the service providers' processes and systems for dealing with cybersecurity threats and protection of the personally identifiable information? So that's a question from the DOL. Is there a privacy and security policy, and does the policy apply to data held by benefit plans? So these are some of the questions that you need to know, because the DOL wants to know if you know. So again, it's another area that we as practitioners need to be raising the bar and stepping up in this area. Many plan sponsors didn't realize that cyber and fraud is coming into fiduciary responsibility and fiduciary duty with the 401k plan. And it has.
With the DOL audits, it sounds like that maybe this was information gathering on their part. What are companies doing as opposed to assessing fines for breaches of fiduciary obligations? Is that accurate?
Yeah, and I haven't seen the Department of Labor come forward yet and issue fines if your cyber and fraud policies are a bit short. I haven't seen it yet. It's not to say that it's not happening. I just haven't seen it. We do know with DOL enforcement, though, that when they put forth their prescription on what they think is good for us to do, we should be paying attention to that and being thoughtful about if we're not doing it, there should be a specific reason why. And we should also expect DOL fines and sanctions to be coming if we've had ample time on our sides to go through these best practices that they've laid out.
Exactly. So to sum things up, Marina, what are some defenses that we as 401k participants can do to protect our accounts?
Well, I mean, one of the things, maybe I'll start at the plan sponsor level. One of the things that we like to see from the plan sponsor is having a process. And again, I'm reiterating something that we've already said, but having a process to review cyber and fraud in the 401k plan on at least an annual basis, and consider having a fraud policy statement. A fraud policy statement for the plan, the 401k plan, works very much like an investment policy statement, where it's got general guidelines and it'll, you know, imagine following a bit of the DOL's guidance. It'll have a section on these are the employer's responsibilities for cyber and fraud. These are the service provider's responsibilities for cyber and fraud. And then the third component of a fraud policy statement is these are the responsibilities that we place on our employees, having two-factor authentication, changing your account password every 90 days, making sure that you're keeping your address up to speed and accurate, using a password manager. I mean, there's a bunch of password managers that are their applications on our phones that store all of the passwords and will automatically change them so that you don't have to think about using different passwords for every single account that we get into. And we all know that's the best practice, but we all know many people don't follow that. Many people have got the same password across all of their different accounts. All it takes is that hacker to have your dark web personal identifiable information in your email, and they can usually find a way to hack into that. If they get one password, they're going to start to use it on your other accounts, and the hacker will be off to the races with your money very quickly. Another thing that we can do is, each of us as individuals, we can call the three main credit bureaus and we can ask them to freeze the credit. Now, what that means is if you were going to go apply for a new credit card and you've asked your credit bureaus to freeze your accounts, your credit card that's running your credit is going to be declined access to your account, which is a very good thing if you are not expecting a credit card to be opened, right? So when you're ready to take out a new credit, whether it's a bank loan or a credit card, you would go into the credit bureaus, take the freeze off for a day or two, wait for the transactions of the credit check to happen, and then go back in and turn the account freeze back on. So that's something that is easy to do, but it's not very commonly thought of as a good protection against some of these fraud instances. The other thing that I'll mention that is kind of interesting, and this was a nuance that came through in one of the cyber and fraud lawsuits, is the hacker actually filed a little postcard with the post office to stop the mail of the participant that they were attacking. Because if there was no mail that was coming in, they could not receive the mail confirmation that the hacker has now stolen $50,000 out of your account. So be watchful if you have mail delivery delays, because it could very well be a sign that there's a hacker in play that doesn't want you to be receiving the mail confirmations that we know the record keeping systems will generate. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
One of those things I would not have thought about. I would have just thought, well, you know, mail's not coming today, or I didn't have anything important. But if that happens for more than a day or two, be very aware that there could be something bigger happening beneath us.
Right. Another example of just kind of old fashioned non-tech sorts of fraud.
Right. Well, you know, the other thing that's happening too, Bruce, is that the hackers are getting they're getting smart, and they're taking many incremental small withdrawals, because those small withdrawals are less likely to be detected by us, especially if we've got everything turned on to, we don't get paper confirmations of everything. Everything's done electronically. So you might get an email from, you know, your 401k provider that says that there's an important notice on your 401k. And how many of us, we just click it, say, yeah, it's the quarterly statement.
Right. But
that notice actually could be, you know, we've processed a distribution for $6,000 out of your account. If that $6,000 withdrawal goes undetected, the hacker is going to be likely to wait 3 or 4 months and come back and do it again. And all they need is a bunch of these to stagger when they're taking withdrawals from which accounts. And they've made themselves right. A very lucrative full-time job.
That's for sure.
Just hacking into our 401k accounts. And many of us won't recognize it because it's happening in small increments.
Right. And we look at the balances, like you were saying, and we think, well, of course, my account's down this quarter. The market was down. And even if it's an up quarter, okay, my account is up, and not realize it's not up as much as it should be.
Right. Fraud. Right. And we're not going in and looking at the transactions. We're just looking, most of us just stop and look at the account balance.
Right.
So, I mean, we're all kind of guilty as charged. Most of us, I'm guessing, hearing this podcast can shake their heads saying, yeah, I'm guilty of that. Yeah, I could be doing more with this. So I think it's a great topic for all of us to be sharing with our children, our family members. This is an area that is ripe for fraud, ripe for hackers to be getting in and abusing them.
That's for sure. Well, some good lessons for all of us. And I want to thank you, Marina, for sharing your experience and expertise and insights with us. It's been very enlightening. And I think we all have some action steps to protect ourselves. I would like to add, if any of our listeners would like to receive a copy of the DOL PDFs or a 35-point fiduciary consideration checklist that Marina and Invesco have put together, you can request that from me at 414-289-3817, or you can email me at Bruce, B-R-U-C-E dot Lanzer, L-A-N, S as in Sam, E-R, at UBS.com. Thank you all for listening, and thank you again, Marina, for your time and sharing your experience.
Thank you, Bruce. Always a pleasure.